From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I'm your Hunter, and I am joined by John. Say hi, John.
Hi.
And this week, we have a very special guest with us. We have a man who is a man of many talents, I would say. He's a author of such books as the Croker series, the upcoming book Lie Catchers, and the Fight Card series of boxing novels. He's a 35-year veteran of the LAPD and was twice honored with the LAPD's Detective of the Year, and is an internationally recognized interrogator, and was the star of the reality TV show Take the Money and Run, which was produced by none other than Jerry Bruckheimer. So this guy is no slouch. He's a man's man. It's Mr. Paul Bishop. Say hello, Paul.
Hey there. Hello, Paul.
It's good to have you on here, man.
It's good to be on. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. John was the one who made me aware of you and your talents. I guess, John, what did you want to get started with? Because there's so much, you know, I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thought we'd have Paul on since this is a movie show. We'll talk about how Paul feels about the portrayal of police officers in movies, like, I guess, in the past and the present, and where it might be going.
Yeah, where it might be going.
The way we're seeing movies these days, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an interesting thing because, I mean, really, police work and what you see in the movies and what you see on television really has nothing to do with the day-to-day type of work that detectives always do, right?
Right.
And most of the guys that I worked with are not like the characters that are portrayed in movies, who you know, are always broken down guys with a haunted past and, you know, ready to eat their gun at any second. I mean, that really isn't the reality by a long shot of the people that I worked with. I mean, most of them were pretty upbeat, have family lives. Yeah, there is some extra stresses to the job. You know, being called out in the middle of the night and things like that. But most of them were pretty even tempered, and we do our job professionally. And so we're not, you know, running up and down the streets with our AK-47s in hand and karate chopping everybody.
One thing I've heard some police officers talk about is how TV shows like CSI and Law and Order sort of give the public this false impression that there's this crack team waiting to solve any case. Like, at any moment, which it would be outrageously cost prohibitive, they said.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that it works for us and it works against us. Mm-hmm. When we're in court, juries expect us to have all of this kind of tricky, you know, up-to-the-date minute evidence, right? I mean, it's not the same juries like the O.J. Simpson jury that just couldn't understand DNA. We've come a long way since then. The public's been a lot more educated about the types of things that police could do. So that can often hinder us, because on those types of shows, they always find some kind of trace evidence. In real life, that's just not the way it is. Also, it works against us when we have real life victims who, for instance, they've had a vandalism at their house, a window's been broken and there's been some blood left on the window, and they are demanding that you do DNA testing on the blood of the suspect who broke their window. Well, their window's worth $50, and a DNA test at a very minimum is $1,500. So the ratio just doesn't work out, and people don't seem to understand that. The other situation is that where it does work for us is when I am and doing an interrogation, if I take a Q-tip swab of somebody's cheek and say, I'll be right back with the DNA results, most of the public has kind of trained themselves to think that you can get DNA results back between commercials.
It really
doesn't work that way.
But so so with DNA, like, you brought up the O.J. Simpson trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about the O.J. Simpson trial the other day because I saw the pictures of O.J. driving down the freeway. I was just a little kid when that happened. But driving down the freeway with the helicopters chasing him. And right. I don't understand how O.J. Simpson got off. I can't wrap my mind around it when I look at stuff like that. And you brought up that the juries didn't understand DNA. Can you elaborate a little bit on just some of that, like how that trial ended up with that verdict? Because it's hard for me to wrap my mind around.
Obviously, there's a lot of things that led up to that trial that were mishandled, and particularly the interrogation. And we can talk about that a little bit, because that's I feel that LAPD has probably one of the worst examples of interrogation on record, and one of the best, and I can tell you about both of those. But as far as what I talked about with the juries in the O.J. Simpson case, the prosecution was trying to force, you know, an education of how DNA works down the jury's throat, and they just didn't want to hear it. What they wanted to see was the entertainment factor provided by the defense team. Mm-hmm. And so, quite frankly, the prosecutors completely misjudged their approach to that case. And there was a lot of evidence that didn't get put in. There was it was a three-ring circus that quite frankly could have been avoided by a correct interrogation at the very beginning, the very night of the incident occurred.
Okay.
Do you want me to elaborate and explain that?
Please.
Okay. So you have to understand the situation. O.J. Simpson is in an interrogation room in the bowels of Central Jail. He has a lawyer with him, but it's a civil lawyer who has allowed him to waive his rights. You have two of LAPD's top hotshot robbery homicide detectives who go down to interview or interrogate him. You know, this is shortly after the murder's been discovered. And they spend literally, and I have the transcript of this, they spend literally 15 minutes in the room with him, and not once do they ask him the pertinent question, did you do it? And then they get up and leave. And then the circus starts. I mean, quite frankly, I don't spend 15 minutes interrogating an indecent exposure suspect. It takes longer than that. And this is probably one of the biggest murder cases, you know, that the LAPD had ever handled. And what happened was they were literally starstruck, is the only thing that I can figure out here, because O.J. Simpson at that time was a god, not only to a lot of people in the country, but particularly to the LAPD. Well, because tournaments. I'm sorry. He was always at our golf tournaments, always doing, you know, appearances and that, and support of police funds and that type of thing. And they just couldn't believe that O.J. Simpson would have done that.
And I had heard that whenever there were the domestic abuse calls, like O.J., you know, police would show up to O.J.'s house and it was like, oh, it's the juice. Like, can I get a picture? You know, it wasn't they weren't really taken seriously.
That was I think that was also part of the issue because of who he was. I think that LAPD, although we have our growing pains and everything else, I think we as a department grew a lot from that experience, and it's a lot different today than it was back then. And things are taken much more seriously. And it's a factor of time change and public perception change and society change, and the police department has to catch up with that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get on this big OJ tangent.
No, but so let's talk about the other side of that, because I've just dissed my alma mater saying they had the worst interrogation on record. But they also have what I consider one of the best interrogations on record, and that is the Stephanie Lazarus case. If you're not familiar with it, Stephanie Lazarus was a 20-year-plus detective working robbery homicide, working art fraud, and evidence turns up that she is the suspect in a 20-year-old murder. And the way this comes about is the victim in that case was the brand-new wife of Stephanie's ex-boyfriend.
Okay.
And at the crime scene at the time, it's 25-plus years ago now, there was clearly signs of a struggle, And when the victim was found dead, she had a bite mark on her arm. So a detective working cold cases decides, well, you know what? Since 25 years ago, we've got all this DNA stuff. You know what? I'm going to see if there was any DNA recovered from that bite mark. And sure enough, there was. So they run it through the system, and there's no hits. There's no matches. And but the DNA is enough that they know that it's female DNA. Mm-hmm. So he looks at who were the other females involved in this case. Well, there was the victim's mother and the victim's sister, and there was some bad blood between them. And so he talks to them, interrogates them, gets them to give DNA samples, no matches. Well, what do we do now, right? So he begins to really dig into the case, and he finds that the only other person that's involved in this case back in the day is Stephanie Lazarus. And she's working right across the hallway from him. So they do manage to surreptitiously get a water bottle, which they get DNA samples from with Stephanie. They put it through the system. And quite frankly, on the Monday morning when that detective walked into work and opened up his package from Scientific Investigation Division, which is our version of CSI, and saw that he had a match between the DNA in the victim's bite mark and Stephanie Lazarus, I'm sure he sucked up about 3 inches of seat cushion at that point.
Jeez.
Because he didn't really know who to go to at that point. Because his immediate supervisor was very good friends with Stephanie Lazarus, went to lunch with her, and he just didn't want this to get out. So he manages to find somebody that he can trust and with this information. And this supervisor is smart enough that he grabs two other detectives, the detective who's got this information, and he immediately sends them off site. And so they're no longer down at the police station, and they go for 2 weeks to an off site location where they practice the interrogation of Stephanie Lazarus, one of their own. Somebody who should know all the keys to interrogation. And so they say, okay, today you play Stephanie and I'll interrogate you, and the other detective will watch and take notes, and we'll see what works. Okay, does this question work? Does that question work? And then the next day they change it around and somebody else would play Stephanie. And they even went so far as to practice defensive techniques in case she became violent in the interrogation room. Well, now they all of a sudden have another barrier to overcome. The chief of police says, yeah, this is all well and good, but we don't talk to suspects who are armed. You need to get her gun off of her. Well, how are you going to do that without giving it away, right? So they decide that they're going to run little ruse, and they go across to Stephanie and say, you know what, we've got a suspect down in the jail who wants to give us some information on some art fraud. And we know nothing about that, but that's your specialty. Would you come down to the jail and talk to this guy? Well, of course, when you go down into the jail, you have to take your gun out and leave it outside. So they take her down to the jail. She leaves her gun outside. They go into the interrogation room, and they begin to ask questions. They begin to go through this thing that they had practiced over and over again. And quite frankly, they didn't think that Stephanie was going to confess to them, but they were looking strictly for deceptive behavior. And with that goal in mind, it was clear that she was, the main suspect in this case and probably guilty of it. And you can go on YouTube and watch the Stephanie Lazarus interrogation. It's about 2 hours long. And it's if you're interested in interrogation, it really is pretty cool. And then, of course, wow. She was convicted rather quickly at trial.
So is that you talked about the prep. Do for any interrogation, is there that level of prep for it, or is it just special cases like that one?
No. Any interrogation requires more preparation than even most detectives take into consideration. Quite frankly, I teach interrogation now, and when I ask detectives at the beginning of the course, what do you do to prepare for an interrogation, they usually say two things. I read the crime report, I look at the suspect's record, and then I go in and talk to him.
Okay.
Well, by the end of the course, it's a 40-hour course, they realize there's about 30 to 40 things that need to be done before they even step in the room and ask the first question. And it is that tactical approach to interrogation that makes it successful. And it's one thing that police departments don't necessarily do. They teach us how to respond to robberies tactically, and other situations all tactically. But when it comes to interrogation, it's let's just go talk to this guy.
Huh. Real quick, Paul, I just want to introduce you to Stuart, who's here.
Hey, Stuart.
Good evening.
Stuart's joining us a little late, but I just wanted to go ahead and introduce you to Stuart since he's just popped in. But we're talking about interrogation right now. Paul was telling us about the best example of interrogation in the history of the LAPD.
Let's take it back to movies, though.
Yes, I was going
to
say,
I'd like to really ask Paul if you could help me out after we finish the show, if you could help me interrogate my co-host, why the hell they couldn't fucking wait 10 minutes for me to jump on. But that's okay. Oh, that's fine.
I'm sure up.
You know, I'm sure we can prosecute them for that.
Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, you can, I don't think you do. And I was about to say you could waterboard me, but I don't think you'll do that. So.
In the movies, you usually see the good cop, bad cop.
Which, I was going to ask you about that.
which is quite frankly illegal. It's a violation of the Fifth Amendment right for somebody not to be intimidated.
Really?
So that, quite frankly, if you do that, you're violating somebody's civil rights, and you can go to jail for that. The other thing is that you see detectives jumping up and down and yelling and screaming and pounding on tables and getting up in people's face. Well, that again falls under the Fifth Amendment, and you really can't do that. The other cliche is they always throw down crime scene photos of the bloody murder in front of the suspect to get him to crack. And that also, the Supreme Court has ruled that that is a form of intimidation and therefore illegal. But so all of these things that you're seeing, but it goes beyond that. Even shows like 48 Hours, which are real detectives, being followed around with cameras.
Yeah, when I worked for the Memphis Film Commission, they had a First 48 show that we helped out with in Memphis. One of those. Sorry.
Right. No. But even when I watch those, I cringe at the interrogations that they do. I mean, it's a standard setup. You have the suspect on one side of this big old hunkin' table and the detective on the other. Well, that table is a complete barrier between you and the suspect. You can't see half of what the suspect body's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not close enough to see some of the dead giveaways as to when they're showing deceptive behaviors. So those types of things, still occur daily. And they're the things that we see in television and movies. And I do think that cops are often influenced by television and movies. Quite frankly, on LAPD, cops didn't ever wear their badges on a dog chain around their neck until they started doing it on NYPD Blue.
Wow.
And New York Undercover was the other show where they did that. And the next thing you know, all these guys in LA are being cool with their badges around their neck on a dog tag chain.
But so you said you can't see half of the deceptive behaviors. So what would be some examples? So if we're trying to figure out if our buddy's lying or something.
Well, the whole fact of the matter is that we talk with our hands, and so we have pretty good control over our upper bodies. The lower body. Has the largest muscle masses in the body, and we can't control those as much as our upper body. We're just not used to doing that because we don't talk with our feet. And so those muscles one of the classic things is it's a very technical term. It's called a butt swipe. And
sounds
and
like an iPhone error.
Suspect literally lifts himself up slightly out of the chair and adjusts himself.
Wow.
And what he's doing is he's trying to bleed off anxiety. So if he hasn't done that while you're asking non-anxiety raising questions, and now you ask an anxiety probing question, and all of a sudden he does a butt swipe. I mean, watch President Clinton being grilled about the Monica Lewinsky thing, and you will see presidential butt swipes all over the place.
This is a term that needs to be introduced: presidential butt swiping.
Well, I guess we're the ones to do it then.
Yes.
So what you're saying is, Paul, it's not like Serpico where they hit him with phone books because it doesn't leave a mark and all that stuff you see ripped off still on TV shows like The
right.
Shield.
I mean, that was 1940s L.A.,
yeah.
right? And times have changed a lot since then. But quite frankly, the movies haven't caught up because it's not quite as dramatic.
But it's realistic, though, if Batman's doing that stuff, right?
Right.
I mean,
I was just going to bring up that when you mentioned phone books there, there was a tactic I've heard over here that I don't know the authenticity or truth to it, but in the 70s, they would have a remember the old chairs that you'd have when they got the backrest, and they'd have two rods, you know, on the edge of it, and there'd be a headrest on top of that. What they would do was grab a big chunky telephone book between the two rods and get it somehow held in there together, and they would actually use a cricket bat behind the back of the phone book with a person placed their head there.
Yeah, I mean, those types of things way back in the day were done. Basically, you know, you could put a phone book over somebody's forearm on a table and hit that phone book with a sap, and the power of that lead tip sap would go all the way through that phone book and just, you know, basically put their arm into agony, but there'd be no sign left of that.
Yeah.
Well, again, this is, first of all, it's totally unnecessary, and secondly, it's illegal, right? So we don't do that. I mean, we sometimes talk in the classes that I do about, okay, we have an interrogation room in every police station. How many of you in the class think there should be a waterboarding room right next door? And it's 50-50 split between the hands that go up in the air. You know, then we have a discussion about, you know, where does torture work? And, you know, I always ended up by saying that's not the question to ask. It isn't whether or not torture works. The question is, even if torture works, should we, as a civilized society and the leaders of the world, do it? That's the moral question that we need to ask ourselves, not whether it works or not.
Mm-hmm. Of course we do it.
Of course we do it.
Have to do it.
You know, and again, but where do we all draw the lines? I mean, that becomes real problematic, because obviously Stuart's going to draw it a lot further out than I am.
Well, he is Australian. That's
Australia for you.
Yeah, really.
They just,
and it was the old, there was down. The old dangling the suspects out the window trick as well that we had here. Yeah. By the ankles.
You know, it didn't work with Ned Kelly, and it ain't going to work now.
Ned Kelly. First Ned Kelly reference
Australian
ever.
Bad guys.
Oops. Hey?
I said, I know my Australian bad guys.
You know your Australian bad guys. Well, at least it doesn't reference Mad Max, so at least it's something different for this time.
There you go.
For once. Limited knowledge my co-hosts have. That's
yeah,
sure
it's all Crocodile Australia. Dundee and Mad Max. That's it.
There you go.
That's all it really
is. You know,
is.
One of my fight card guys, David Foster, he wrote one of the fight card books that he wrote was The Fist of Ned Kelly. And, you know, he based it on an incident out of Ned Kelly's life. And I think he did a terrific job on it. I think it was one of the best in the series that we did.
And Fist of Ned Kelly sounds like a Bruce Lee knockoff.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
And Fight Card is the boxing series that you and Mel Odom created?
Yes.
And so it's a bunch of different authors working on them.
Right. It didn't start out that way. It started out as a conversation between Mel and I about, you know, we both had in common that we used to like the boxing stories out of the old pulp magazines. In fact, we both collected them.
Like Robert E. Howard's stories.
Yeah, like Robert E. Howard's. And there were a ton back in the 40s. I mean, it was one of the mainstays of the sports pulps.
Right.
And we thought, well, you know, with the new publishing world with Amazon, we could do a couple of those ourselves and just have fun with them, because the ebook revolution has brought back the novelette, which was basically a dead art form. Nobody would publish a novelette. Well, with ebooks, we can do that. So he and I both wrote one, and the next thing you know, some of our author buddies were going, "Hey, can we write one of these? Hey, can we write one of these?" And 42 books later, 45 books later, I think now, the series is still going strong. 45 books and probably 39 different authors.
And if you want to check those out, listeners, you can go to fightcardbooks.com and more of Paul's work is available at paulbishopbooks.com.
Yes.
But, yeah, I found that Fight Card has its own separate website. And, man, there's a lot of these. Got to check these out.
How big are those books? How many pages roughly?
They run between 25,000 and 30,000 words.
Would be about, trying to break that down in my head.
You're talking about 158 pages, 160 pages.
Okay. Oh, wow. So it's a decent read still. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good lean.
They are.
Sounds like the old 87th Precinct novels. Like
right.
That.
But what fascinated me about this is how many stories can you write about boxing? And yet every single one of these books has a very different slant to it. There's no two plots that are alike. There's no two characters that are alike. The only thing that we really, really emphasized was that boxing had to be at the heart of the story and had to resolve the story. Didn't have to be about the heavyweight championship of the world. It could be two guys in Poughkeepsie fighting over the love of a girl.
My ring's outside.
Yeah. but boxing had to be right at the forefront and not just a background to a mystery story or something like that. And we've had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, that makes when you say a background to a mystery story, it immediately makes me think of James Ellroy's Black Dahlia Murder or something.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, then you think about how many novels Dick Francis wrote about horse racing and had all these mysteries set around the racetrack. So you could probably write a novel about anything in multiple volumes.
So the Fight Card, it's the concept is that they're all stories centered around boxing. There's no continue through line with them in terms.
No, a couple of us have written sequels. Eric Beatner wrote a sequel to his first book, and I wrote a sequel. One of the books that I wrote was called Felony Fist, and then the follow up was Swamp Walloper with the same character. So that's happened a couple of times, but mostly these are all different and separate.
Okay.
And we started out just having them in the, you know, Mel and I were saying, okay, these are all going to be set in the 1950s. And then Terrence McCauley, who's really beginning to hit his stride as a writer now, he wrote a book called Prohibition about an ex-boxer who turns mafia muscle man. And he and I were talking one day, and he said, well, I really like to write the story about how he became an ex-boxer. And he said, but, you guys are only 1950s, and this is set in the 1920s. And I said, I want that story. We'll do that story. And all of a sudden, I realized we were limiting ourselves. And so we kind of really loosened up on the time frame. And we even instituted a Fight Card MMA brand.
Oh, wow.
To bring it right into the current day of the mixed martial arts. So, we found a couple of guys that were actually very involved in MMA and were also writers, and they turned out some great books. So it's been a learning process, and believe it or not, we even did a Fight Card romance.
Yeah, I saw some
another audience.
I saw some that looked kind of lusty, like Ladies Night. I don't know.
That was the Fight Card romance, exactly. Yeah. There you go.
I want to ask about the authenticity of television shows, and in particular characters like Columbo and Kojak, and your thoughts are on those.
I mean, those are all television fantasies. They're television fantasy cops. We like them, we're comfortable with them, but in reality they have little to do with real police work.
Yeah, it's like I was gonna say, like, because I mean, I like a lot of the fantasy cop stuff. I understand that it's not like based in reality. Because
right.
It's, you know, I get that it's just like it's fun, but it gets annoying though when it crosses over into reality, like what you were saying about the LA people wearing the badges on the chains and stuff, like where it's sort of people start to see it as reality, and that's where it becomes problematic.
Right.
How many cops acted like Steve McQueen in Bullet after that was a hit?
Oh, I heard that they were all wearing their holsters like Tashi. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And all driving Mustangs. Like,
oh,
that's
going
to happen, right?
Yeah, yeah. You have fun taking that to the shop every other month.
Exactly.
On that,
the thing about that is that, you know, even for me, you know, I've written 15 books now. The 15th one, Lie Catchers, is about to come out. And what I really, you know, I write cop stuff, and I try to make it at least close to reality, but with Lie Catchers in particular, because I'm so passionate about the art of interrogation, I wanted to get the the things that were in it as close to reality as fiction would allow. And so all of the techniques that are used in the books, in this book in particular, by the two main characters, Ray Pagan and Calamity Jane Randall, they're all stuff that I've either done or have known to be done. And that kind of, you know, made me pleased as a writer to be able to do that actually on the page.
Yeah, I was, because I was reading about Lycatchers, and I was going to ask you about how much of your own experience comes into it, if any of it was autobiographical, or was it fictional and just, you know, applying that real-life experience?
There are some autobiographical parts of this infused in the characters, but they really are their own characters. I think as authors and writers, you know, everything's autobiographical to a certain extent, because sure. we've either heard things or had experiences and we're processing them onto the to the written page. But those characters aren't me, and but some of the many of the things that they do are things that I brought to this from my experiences in the box, as we say.
And so when does the book come out?
It should be out in September, the first part of September, and I'm kind of excited to get it launched and off the ground.
Yeah, if you go to paulbishopbooks.com, you can stay in touch with that, and there are links to buy the books on Amazon. If they, if the listeners go through your page to click through
yes.
Amazon, do you get a little kickback from that?
I think there is, but it's so minimal it doesn't even make a check once a month. It would be once
okay.
every 6 months, maybe for $1.98.
Well, if you want to give Paul a little bump, go through, you know, buy the books through Amazon through his through paulbishopbooks.com. You know, maybe put a couple, but maybe
right.
maybe you can buy Paul a pack of gum or something.
There you go. But no, the book royalties will be much nicer than the bump they give you for going through your webpage. But
sure.
I should say that I have seen many of Paul's books from the 80s in used bookstores just read to death. Like the type that people have just cracked the spines on, like they read them like five times. So there's definitely something there.
Well, you know, here's a real life thing that that happened. You know, my partner and I in the real world police work go out to serve a search and arrest warrant on a suspect, and you know, we get to his house and, you know, knock on the door, and the guy's really cooperative. We knew he would be cooperative. And so we've got him up out of bed, and he's wearing, you know, a robe and his birthday suit. And, you know, because he's being cooperative, we decide that we'll let him get dressed before we take him to jail. So what this necessitates is me standing in at the entry to the guy's bedroom with the suspect while my partner goes around, and the suspect says, yeah, my pants are on that side of the bed. My dirty underwear is over there. And so my partner's picking up all this stuff, and my partner's on the side of the bed, and he looks on the nightstand, and here's one of my books face down, splayed open. The suspect was in the middle of reading. I mean, what are the odds?
Did you offer to sign it for him?
The book you're reading, the author's going to turn up the next day to arrest you.
Yeah,
did you
really?
Say, hey, I'll sign your book?
Yeah, I'll sign your book. I actually put on extra charges for him breaking a spine.
Listen, you need to treat these books better, pal.
Yeah, buddy.
Buddy.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here on the MMC, and we will be right back with Paul Bishop right after this.
Do you enjoy watching movies?
Of course.
Do you enjoy talking about movies?
Don't be a fucking idiot.
Do you know what the only thing better than watching movies and talking about movies is?
I have no idea.
I'll tell you what is. Listening to two complete strangers talk about movies you may or may not have seen.
Stranger danger.
But I know what you're thinking. Where can someone like me find something like that?
Unknown area.
Well, over here at the Film Thugs.
The Film Thugs. The Film Thugs. The Film Thugs.
We proudly offer just such a service to you.
We service you.
And I know what you're thinking. How can someone like me afford a service as amazing as this?
Recession!
Well, we proudly offer all of our quality content to you absolutely free of charge.
Free bullshit!
That's right, over at the Film Thugs.
The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs!
We have over 100 episodes of quality film discussion.
Quality is relative.
We tackle the important questions. Questions like, is Sylvester Stallone secretly a genius?
Of course!
Is Roman Polanski a pedophile rapist?
You bet!
Is Christopher Nolan just too damn good?
You bet your ass!
So head on over to thefilmthugs.com.
The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs!
.com. And get your fill of us.
We want to be inside you.
So remember, the Film Thugs!
The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs! The Film Thugs!
The only podcast you'll ever need.
Can you teach me how to love?
I think that's it.
Yeah, that's
good.
All right, and we're back here on the Midnight Movie Cowboys with our guest writer, interrogator, detective, all-around Renaissance man, Mr. Paul Bishop. You can visit his website, paulbishopbooks.com. You can follow him on the Twitter at... I don't have it in front of me. What's your Twitter
Bish's
handle?
Beat. At Bish's Beat.
Bish's Beat.
B-H-S Beat.
Great. And you can also look him up on Facebook as well. And so you're all over those the social media.
Yeah, but, I mean, who knows how much good that does, but if you don't have it, you get strange looks.
Yeah. But again, paulbishopbooks.com, all the info's there. So, Paul, shifting it back to movies a little bit, what are some police movies that you like? And it, I'm not necessarily, like, realistic, that like not based on realism, but just ones that you enjoy, ones that for and the reasons why you particularly would pick those movies.
That's kind of tough because
it's kind of broad. Sorry.
Yeah. No. It's one of those things that I have a tendency to avoid those movies because I go into them. I work that stuff all day. I don't want to go look at it at night.
Right. Okay.
But I'll tell you what, the most realistic cop show of all time, in my estimation, was Barney Miller.
Barney Miller.
Barney Miller, yep. A 30-minute sitcom, and why it was realistic was it absolutely captured the humor of what goes in a squad room on a regular basis.
Okay.
And that was more real to me than all of the other cop shows that you see on television, the Starsky and Hutches and that type of thing, which is all very cool. If you were at a party and Jessica Fletcher turned up, you better flee because somebody's going to die within the next 15 minutes. You know, Cabot Cove has got to have the most highest murder rate of anywhere in the country.
So you weren't wearing pastel colors throughout the 80s like Don Johnson and...
Yeah, not on duty. Off duty, maybe, but I won't come out.
You have a boat with a pet gator and all that as well.
You know, and as I drive around in my Ferrari, you know, Phil Collins was singing in the background on a regular basis.
Really?
The greatest.
He asked to follow me around.
Yeah. Man, that shows. I love Miami Vice. God, it's so full of shit, really. It's been far removed from police work. I can imagine there's anything.
I went back and watched some because I thought it was very realistic when I was a kid. And, of course, looking at it now, it's like a live-action comic book.
Oh, yeah, it totally is.
The operative words being when I was a kid. That's what saves us, I think.
There's no there, right? There's no substance there. But there was the British series Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren. I thought
it
was outstanding. Yeah. And then, you know, they brought that show over here, and it lasted one season. And I think the problem why it lasted one season was it was too realistic. That show really captured, a lot of the way police work was done and the dynamics of working within a police department. So,
what about shows like The Bill, the British show The Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with The Bill. Again, you're talking back in the what, 60s or 70s?
And, no, The Bill was like the 80s and 90s more.
Okay. It was really The Bill was more of a soap opera than a police procedural most of the time.
Okay.
You know, and you were spending time with the characters because you enjoyed spending time with the characters. You weren't there because of the mysteries they were solving.
What about Miss Marple?
Oh, I love Miss Marple.
Okay, that's good.
You know, it's pure fantasy, right? and I love to escape into that stuff.
And Murder, She Wrote, yeah, all that sort of stuff. Right. Okay.
You know, has no basis in what...
I'm not being clever. I'm honestly trying to just determine what you do and don't like and what...
Yeah, I was curious about the Sweeney, because I always hear about that.
The Sweeney was fantastic.
Yeah, the Sweeney was great. Still is. Okay. I mean, I think I love watching the videos of the Sweeney. I mean, I think it still holds up really well.
Apparently, the movie with Ray Winstone, not so good, though.
No, but, you know, the fact is, for me, I have two cousins that were... I was born and raised in England. I came over to America when I was 8, immigrated with my parents. Actually ran away from home and left them in England. But, you know, so
you're not going to sit there and gloat about winning the Ashes.
Back, you know, as an adult, and I would go back and hang out with my cousins and their police buddies. And at that time, they were going, well, you know, do you guys get to drive Torinos like Starsky and Hutch do and all that kind of stuff? And I went, yeah, we do. Just like you guys get to drive the, you know, the Jags and everything that are in the Sweeney and get beat people. They go, oh, the Sweeney's
not professionals.
Going, either Starsky and Hutch.
And like us over here, we get to ride kangaroos to school, don't we, guys? Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely.
No, yeah, you guys ride interceptors to school.
You guys drive like Ford Falcons with like souped up nitroglycerin engines.
Yeah, if we can afford them these days, they go for a packet, those things.
Like that.
Oh, easily. Yeah. Easily. you couldn't give them away back in the 80s. Now everybody wants one and you're paying through the nose for it.
Wow.
So with movies, though, you know, the thing is that, you know, you get like the Lethal Weapon series. And you know, again, you know, sequels and all that kind of stuff kind of go downhill. Mm-hmm. But they were entertaining. They were fun. And it really was about the relationship of the characters. But the dramatic turns and the big explosions and all of that kind of stuff just really don't occur in the real world.
So you never had to deal with a guy screaming diplomatic immunity as he shot people?
Not as he shot people. I've had to deal with guys screaming diplomatic immunity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but unfortunately I knew that they weren't, and so...
They saw Lethal Weapon too. That's what.
Yeah, we just used that amount of force necessary to take him into custody.
That's what one thing has always bugged me in the films is, and I'm sure it's complete BS, is when a member of the general public has information and wants in on the case. I mean, that's just, I've never ever spawned to that crap.
Well,
like,
Joe Pesci
in Lethal Weapon 2 is the perfect example, you know? He's like, he's an informant or whatever.
It becomes a bit ridiculous. I mean, even Castle, you know, the current show on television, which is just kind of like Murder, She Wrote, light. You got to watch that for the characters, but to think that a writer, you know, is going to get to go out and hang out with policemen on a regular basis because he's such a bright guy, you know, just the liability alone would make that ridiculous, let alone everything else. But it's entertainment, and that's, you know, people watch those shows because of the characters.
Is there ever been any character or any actor who's ever nailed it so much to the point that it's hit home to you? We thought, boy, it's about as close as anything I'll ever see on the big screen or any actor's portrayal.
Like, in terms of, like, do you mean in movies, Stuart? Like,
in terms
of television?
Movies and television, I mean, there's not much that different to them. I mean, one's a longer medium to the other.
Oh, what was the name of the show earlier?
We talked about Barney Miller, you know, Hill Street Blues, you know, in the very beginning, even NYPD Blue in the very beginning. Before they started stretching for stories and stuff like that, had some pretty good portrayals of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you go back to a Police Story, which was produced by Joe Wamba because of Wamba's participation in that. It became, I think that was very realistic for many of those episodes.
Okay, but any actor actually nailed it as a police officer or a detective or anything, we thought that's, I know guys like that who are that, it's that the portrayal is that close to somebody you know or people you know.
I really can't, you know, for actually at the moment, I can't really answer that. I don't know the answer to that question.
So not even in the past, there's been nothing that's grabbed you like that? Well, for instance, let's say Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry.
No. Let's not say that.
Don't destroy my dreams, Paul.
I mean, the current Harry Bosch series, I think, that Amazon is streaming. I think Michael Connelly comes, both his books and the television show come the closest to cop reality as anything I've ever read. I mean, I can read Michael Connelly's books and try to nitpick them to death and not get anywhere because they're pretty darn close to the real world.
Titus Welver is great on that show too.
Right, and so there is some you know adjustment that has to be made because it's fiction. You're not going to have one character involved in so many big cases, but the actual investigation and the way that the characters talk to each other, I mean, Michael just nails it.
I'm trying to figure out how I want to ask this question because I don't really know how, but or how I'm going to relate it to movies. There's sort of recently in the press, there's a very negative feelings towards police officers.
Really? I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, you know, now they're wired to the hilt with cameras. And I was seeing stories recently about cops saying that they like them getting beaten up and saying, well, I didn't retaliate because I don't want to be the next racist cop plastered all over the news who kills a black guy. And I've seen like stories about officers like, you know, having several stories like that. And I was just wondering I'm trying to point the question a bit, but what you think about sort of the way the culture's going in regards to the law enforcement?
I mean, quite frankly, I've thought a lot about this, and police departments, you know, law enforcement's in crisis right now across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this stuff. I mean, my opinion on the lapel cameras is I think they're great because I think they're going to exonerate more officers than they're going to prosecute. And those ones that they do show doing bad things, those guys need to be taken off the streets,
absolutely,
right?
I mean, absolutely.
You know, yeah. I have no issue with that. I think part of what's happening is police departments, right from the very inception of bringing a rookie policeman into the police academy, you know, they teach them how to shoot their guns. They teach them how to drive cars fast in pursuits. They teach them just enough of the penal code to get in trouble, but they don't teach them how to talk to people.
How to approach these situations.
Right, all that other stuff has to be taught. I mean, that's really important. Officer safety has to be tantamount. But 99.9% of their job is talking to people and resolving situations. And that's not, you know, where we go with this stuff. When a police department gets, you know, they do training by litigation. We get sued, so they set up a training class to tell you what you can't do anymore, instead of doing proactive type of training. And there's a lot of different things that are going on in police work that could do with a refreshing change. That's not to say that society itself isn't contributing to a lot of this, especially the media, who loves to stir the pot and step back to see what happens. And there are a number of politicians who also like to do the same things because they get their coffers filled by agitation, not by calming the situation.
Exactly.
And so there's and quite frankly, you know, society is becoming very rude and aggressive. Just in general.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing the respect for authority, not just against the police department, but in schools and everywhere else that we or a society are responsible for. And the police are being caught in the middle of that. You know, in city government, which really, you know, controls the police department, you're split between one faction that wants to use, you know, a very conservative faction that wants to use the police department as an occupying force to put down, you know, any resistance. Resistance is futile. We'll send out our jackbooted thugs to take care of you. And the other faction at the very other end of the spectrum is those people that want everything to be politically correct, that, you know, you can't do anything that's going to offend anybody. And the result of that is situations where I was talking to some welfare fraud investigators the other day. Now, these guys work alone. They go into some of the nastiest parts of the city to talk to people about whether or not they're cheating on their welfare. And they are not allowed to interview people or even, you know, let alone interrogate them. All they're allowed to do is have a conversation with them. Now that gets a bit ridiculous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about somebody who's ripping off the welfare system and all you can do is have a conversation with them because you don't want to offend anybody. So the problem is that the police are caught in the middle of this type of thing. Law enforcement's caught in the middle. And what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? There are changes afoot, and it needs to come, but it's got to be just not the police department. It's got to be society in general.
And because, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but police departments are typically a reflection of – they're all municipal, and, you know, so they're kind of a reflection of the community that they serve, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, when the community becomes upset about deadbeat dads, all of a sudden we're going out and enforcing the laws that deadbeat dads are involved with. When child abuse becomes a big hot button potato, all of a sudden we're going out and enforcing all of those things to the nth degree. So we, you know, the police department really is supposed to respond to what the public expects from it.
Right.
And they try to do that. Here's where the problem lies. LAPD, I think, is a shining example of a fully integrated department. It's taken them years, and there's been a lot of growing pains. But the LAPD of 2015 almost exactly reflects the ethnic and gender makeup of the city, which is a wonderful thing. And it's to the point where LAPD, you know, working with the guys at LAPD, it just doesn't occur to us that somebody's black or Mexican or, you know, Hispanic or white or just, you know, we're all blue.
Right.
It just is the way it is. It hasn't always been that way, but that's the way it is now. But then you have situations like Ferguson where your small police department, granted, but it's 99% white. They have one black guy.
Mm-hmm.
But the populace that they serve is 95% black.
Right.
That imbalance is a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. It sort of creates an antagonistic relationship with the police just based on the
makeup.
That these are people that are not from their culture, not from their community. They can't identify with them, therefore they don't trust them.
Right.
I also see that as a reflection of the community, though, because, you know, in the, like, let's say the worst neighborhoods, the rep is snitches are bitches, don't mm-hmm. talk to cops, all cops are pigs. So what young kid wants to grow up to be a cop?
Right.
Yeah.
It's sort of a back and forth. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem with the Ferguson situation.
Right. And recruiting is tough to find qualified people to do this job. And, you know, back in my day when I came on the job, this was a career you aspired to. Unfortunately, what we're seeing with a lot of the new recruits is they're taking this job until they find something better. And that's not an attitude.
That's bad.
It's a transition job.
Yes.
You know what? I think I'll just be a cop until
it's like selling cars.
Comes along.
Yeah, and I don't want to work weekends, and I don't want to work morning watch. So it's a different, changing world out there that we're having to adapt to.
Yeah, because if you watched something like Dragnet, you know, the old Jack Webb version, of course, it's like it makes it look like it's the most dignified, honorable job you can have in society.
It is.
Yeah. And
it is.
Yeah, and there's those terrific speeches of Jack Webb that he right. does on those shows that you can play them today, and they're really moving. Like
they are really moving. You know?
And I guess there was this time where they were making fun of him because he was the authority or whatever. It's like, but that stuff holds up a lot better than anything the hippies are saying on those shows.
Right. And you know, I quite frankly, I agree with all the things that you know, Jack Webb's character, Joe Friday, spouted. I mean, that's why I came on this job. Yeah. It is an honorable profession. And it's being brought into dishonor by a few officers that are making mistakes. I mean, you think of the number of police contacts across the nation on a daily basis and that go down successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what is being focused on is all the isolated incidents that the media and the politicians are jumping on. Do those things need to be resolved? Do those things need to be addressed? Absolutely. But that's not the backbone of police work.
Well, I feel like those are stories of choice. Like mm-hmm, they intentionally put those stories out there to cause a ruckus, cause controversy, because it kind of plugs into that primal hatred of authority that, you know, a lot of people might have or their viewers might have. That would be my guess.
Yeah, no, I agree.
John said that Dragnet made police work look like the most honorable job you can have, and you said that it actually is. What made you want to aspire to be a police officer? or to join the LAPD, rather.
Yeah, well, there's kind of two parts of that, and one of it will sound kind of silly, but it was very real at the time. As a 10-year-old, I was so enamored with the Man from U.N.C.L.E. that I just announced to my parents, you know what, I'm going to be a cop. And LAPD had initials in it, like U.N.C.L.E. did, so that was a place I was headed to.
So what's the verdict on the new Guy Ritchie Man from U.N.C.L.E., Paul?
I think it's a very, very good film. It's not a great film. I love so many individual things about it. And I like Guy Ritchie as a director. I like the actors. I think they did a great job in their portrayals. There are a couple of times in the movie that it loses momentum. Okay. And that's what takes it from being great down to just very, very good. It's entertaining. I loved it. I'm going back to see it again. And, you know, it's not the movie that I had hoped for, but it's one that I'm satisfied with.
Okay. And what was the second part to your...
Well, the second part was that I just found, you know, as I grew up, even though I never lost that idea that I wanted to be a cop, I mean, I was in the Law Enforcement Explorers, you know, and all of this kind of stuff. And it just fascinated me. These guys that were doing this job were my heroes. I saw them as having the responsibility of the world on their shoulders, and I wanted to share in that. I felt I could do that. And it was also a job that I knew that you could do a lot of different things. You know, you could do auto theft, you could do burglaries, you could, you know, whatever. You could stay in patrol your entire career. And for me, I was very fortunate. You know, I knew I wanted to be a detective, and I made a beeline for detectives as soon as I could. I mean, usually you have to have 7 to 10 years on before you get in the detective bureau, and I was back there within 2 years by Machiavellian moves and manipulations. But that's where, you know, I knew I wanted to go, and I was driven to get there. And within a very short time of being back there, within 6 months, I was working sex crimes, and that was what I did for the rest of my career.
So if you become a detective, is interrogation go part and parcel with that?
It does to a great degree, but particularly in sex crimes investigation, because a great majority of what we did in sex crimes was he said, she said situations. And to get to the truth of the matter, and therein lies the key, to get to the truth of the matter. Most people think the truth is a fixed point, but it's an ever-changing point.
It's like Rashomon, you know.
Yeah. So it's for me, that became the you know, be-all and end-all of doing my job was, how do I get a really bad guy who's done something heinous to tell me about it when he knows he's going to go to jail for 20, 30 years for what he's done? If he tells me,
You know, dangle him out the window.
Dangle him out the window. Yeah. Hit him with a phone book.
That's it.
That's where the term book'em came from.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, wow. I was going to say, wow.
I so wanted that to be true, too.
Yeah. I did. I was like, oh, please.
Okay. You guys, I had all three of you.
Yes.
Nah, you didn't. Not me.
Not you.
I'm a strain.
I'm coming down there to dangle you out a window, mate.
I am. That's how we have fun. You won't be doing nothing. You just, that's how we enjoy our day. So
yeah, I've seen those movies. It's just.
But what do you think when we use the term "you want to hang out"? That's what we mean. Literally, you want to hang out.
That's they party hard over there.
All right.
But anyway, oh my gosh, I forgot what my next question was going to be. Oh my gosh, my train of thought's gone.
Too much humor.
John, did you have anything you wanted to dig into?
Yeah, I was curious. It's funny because you watch a movie or read the book Serpico, and it doesn't really have the most positive portrayal of the police department. No. And also the Joseph Wambaugh books, really, it doesn't make it look like it's, you know, roses and bourbon or whatever. And it's just, I noticed that a lot of times when they'll interview like police officers, they'll say, oh, it was Serpico or the Joseph Wambaugh books that got me into wanting to be a cop, because they were too, you know, too young to have probably watched Joe Friday.
Right.
And no, I was just curious what you thought of those books, those movies and sources, how they affected police work in the 70s or recruitment of police officers.
Well, I mean, I think the Serpico books, I mean, really tore back the quite frankly, the toilet lid on what was the NYPD back in the day. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's a department that's also come a long way, but the organized corruption that was there at that time was quite frankly appalling. And, you know, with LAPD, yes, we have had incidents of corruption. You can point to the Rampart scandal, the Hollywood burglars. But these were really isolated groups. It wasn't endemic throughout the whole department. And the Wamba books, I mean, I think Wamba is one of my great influences as both a cop and a writer. I think his prose rises to the level of literature. I mean, it's something that I aspire to with my writing. But Wamba, he wrote about what I refer to as the Womboys. And these are the cops that wake up with a hangover in somebody's bed other than their own. And they go out and spend their day in the gutter dealing with all the denizens that are there. And then at night they go to the local bar and drink the pain away. That was the standard of some of the police guys back in the 70s. When I came on the job, that was a turning point. The days of the choir boys was just ending when I came on in 77. And the department was becoming a much leaner, much harder, much more professional organization. So the cops that I write about really kind of reflect my experience with the cops. And that wasn't the Wamba experience. I think he was really did a true reflection of what he saw in the department and officers in his time with the department. And I tried to do the same with mine. And I think that's what gives me a little bit of perspective. I mean, my cops are ultimately optimistic, and right. And Wambas are also ultimately pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a question? You don't have to answer.
This is not that kind of show. You can't ask questions.
He's the interrogator, Stu.
Yeah. I'm the one asking the questions here.
Okay. I want to know, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. Are you able to talk about the LA riots and Daryl Gates at all?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Let's put it this way.
Yeah.
You know, Gates was my police chief. And I think he was a real policeman's police chief, but he refused to change. And as the city changed, Gates refused to change. And that led to the situation that we had with Rodney King and the LA riots. And his time had come and gone. I respect the man completely, but there were a lot of things that happened there. You know, during the riots, everybody in the department was out on the streets. We were riding three to a car, and I was in more shootings, more fights, and more danger in those couple of weeks and all the rest of my career put together. It was an ugly, ugly time. I mean, you have to understand that in those days, the firemen didn't have flak vests.
Oh.
So they were being sniped at as they were up there putting out the fires, and we were having to go off the ladders behind them because we had vests on, bulletproof vests on.
Oh my gosh!
So, because we were living bulletproof vests for the firemen back in those days.
Jeez. Oh my God. Okay, because I was going to ask you just how smeared was Gates' character put throughout the media? Because he was pretty much just vilified. Like the whipping boy.
He was vilified. To a certain extent, it happened on his watch, and you know there were some things that not there were some big things. That he allowed to go on and cause the fact that he, when the Rodney King verdict was coming back on the officers that were being prosecuted, he had the entire staff, administrative staff of the LAPD up in Santa Barbara at a leadership conference. Well, what kind of leadership was that? You've got the biggest decision coming down the pike here that's going to affect the city, and every supposed leader is, you know, out of the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, there was some heavy-duty responsibility there. I don't think, however, that wiped out his legacy. I mean, I think that the professionalism that Gates brought to the department, the changes that Gates insisted on in the department, were good things and great things. And unfortunately, he kind of outstayed his welcome.
Okay. Because there was this cause to make Rodney King a martyr after the fact, which... I want to know what the feeling was amongst the your officers, your colleagues there, knowing that, you know, with King's criminal history that he had, and you know, before and after the fact, how much
it was
pissed you off, basically. Yeah,
it was very frustrating. I mean, the 10-second snippet of the Rodney King beating that is you know, was shown repeatedly on television is not made right if you look at the entire film of the incident, but it becomes a lot more understandable when you see the entire video that was taken.
That was my next point. Yeah, that they've only shown a fraction of that video, right, just to give off, you know, to paint it as a one-sided affair, basically. Yeah.
Right. And you know, sometimes the mob mentality takes over. And should we be professional and above that? Absolutely. But you know what? Anytime you hit somebody with a baton, it doesn't look pretty, no matter how justified it is. And I'm not saying that Rodney King situation was justified. I'm just saying that it then it looks even worse. But even just a very justified use of that tool looks very ugly if somebody captures a snippet of it on film.
Any show of force out of context, it looks like you're beating a helpless victim, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but what they didn't say, well, did it come out that he was actually high on PCP at the time where he was?
Yes.
He did. Yeah, it was known.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he was feeling no pain, and he kept getting up and kept getting up, and he wouldn't do what the officer said. Now, should there have been a better way to handle that? Yeah. And a lot of things have changed for LAPD to handle those types of situations differently today. But those changes wouldn't have come around unless there was this spark to do it. Unfortunately, it was a spark that set the city on fire.
Ugh. Yeah.
I always love when those clips get out, how everybody is suddenly an expert on street fighting.
Yeah.
And, cop should have done a judo toss and
that's something
grabbed his arm in an Aikido move.
That's something that drives me crazy is when people talk about any of these instances, like with Mike Brown and Darren Wilson or something like that. They always talk like they're all of a sudden everybody's an armchair police officer. Well, here's what the cops should have done.
All the Facebook pundits.
I know. I was like, oh, really? Guy who's never left college in his life, you're going to tell me how a cop should have – you're going to tell this cop how he should have done his job? Okay.
You should have taken him out like Chuck Norris did in Code of Silence.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I mean, the situation is we get asked a lot, why didn't you shoot the gun out of his hand? Why didn't you shoot the
anybody who says that has never shot a gun in their life.
You know, you shoot to kill. No, we don't. We shoot to stop, and that involves shooting at the major body mass.
Yeah, you shoot at the torso, right?
Right. You shoot to stop. You don't shoot to wound. I mean, that's Roy Rogers stuff.
They always go like, why didn't they aim for the legs?
Yeah.
Why did they shoot the tires out?
No, why didn't they kneecap him?
Why did you have to shoot somebody who's coming at you with a knife? Well, because I'm wearing a bulletproof vest, not a knife-proof vest.
Yeah. Oh, God.
You know? And what are you going to do if somebody comes at you with a knife or comes at one of your loved ones with a knife? What do you want them to do? You know, nobody takes that into consideration.
No.
You know, cops have a right to go home at night.
Yeah.
I mean, especially the wages they earn. They deserve a shitload more than that.
So, yeah, are bad decisions made? Yes. And when bad decisions are made, we need to look at them objectively. And if there's criminal activity involved, then you know, there needs to be prosecution. If it's just a mistake and bad tactics, then those things have to be trained for so that we don't do it again.
See, the thing is as well that we were talking about, I might have been talking with somebody about, was the Ferguson riots recently of Mike Brown. I think, in all honesty, let me be pretty blunt the way I put it, I don't think 99% of the people who rioted really gave a fuck if he died or not. They just wanted all the free looting and shit. That's all. I think the same went with the LA riots. I mean, there might have been, you know, an undercurrent of anger.
Yeah. I mean,
but a lot of it was just a free-for-all, basically.
And just like anything else, there are good people and bad people, right? And there are people that are there to take advantage of the situation and others who are righteously angry. I mean, I look at the Black Lives Matter movement, and there are a lot of people and conservative things that just think they're a bunch of radicals. Quite frankly, I think they've got a point. And you know, they're not necessarily going about it in the best way, but they've got to do something to draw attention to the fact that there is an inordinate number of black men that are being killed by police officers in this country and why. And you know, I don't think that there's any movement of cops cohering to let's go out and kill black men today. But I do think it is a situation that is awkward and we don't want to address it and we don't want to talk about it. And something like the Black Lives Matter movement makes us do that. I think it's a tool of social change.
But the thing is, well, it only seems to be the reports of black deaths by police. It's never the white ones. And I'm not trying to pull a race card with this. I'm just saying it's because somebody wants to take the death of someone who needed. I wouldn't say needed to be shot dead. That's wrong.
Well, okay. You know, if they just done what they were asked to do, or told to do,
if they complied,
if they could have their day in court, they could sue the department. They could do. You know, there is a process to follow. But here's something that most people never want to address. There is one police officer in this country killed every 58 hours.
Wow.
Okay. Jeez.
Now, if that was celebrities, doctors, would we not be up in arms about that?
Oh, yeah. You'd never hear the end.
Oh, absolutely.
People just go, it comes with the job.
They're policemen. Supposed to do that.
I got a question for you as well.
It's all a matter of perspective.
Sure. There's something that's been bugging me as well. I mean, you know when you see, and this is really trivial, but it's just something that's bugged me for the longest time. When you see celebrities, okay, I know what happens here, and they got 15 police officers with them as a guards or escorts, whatever. Does it bug you or bother you personally that all those resources are being ripped out of the system for this one person?
Well, it bugs me when I flew into Oakland the other day and they had the terminal closed down because Justin Bieber was coming through.
Oh, jeez.
Right? But on the other hand, if they hadn't have done that, what would the result be? Are there stupid people out there who would have caused a massive problem? Absolutely. Yeah. So what is the lesser of those two evils? Right? What is going to protect the safety of the public the most? And a lot of those cops that you see with celebrities are off duty. Mm-hmm. They're off duty jobs.
Oh, really?
They have. So it's not that the police department is throwing a chunk of, like, you see all the policemen out at the Oscars and stuff like that. Many of them are on duty because there's traffic control situations in that, and some of them are not. Some of them are off duty and working a side job with the department's permission.
Okay, clears that up. No, it really does. It clears it up. It's why is all these resources being wasted on this one person? I really couldn't care less.
Yeah, it if you think it's the public dime being spent on that, you know, you kind of maybe bristle.
Yeah.
But if they're just making some money on the side, so everybody wins.
Yeah, that's all right. That's good. All right, no worries then.
How do you think I put my kid through college? No, just kidding. Nope.
New kids on the
Johnny,
block.
Elton John pays well.
Sidearm.
Yeah. Paul was Marky Mark's off-duty officer. He was depicted in Entourage
I got to pick out all his boxers.
Yes.
That's why I always respected David Lee Roth for having like the midget security force. I always thought that was like the greatest spoof on celebrity that you'd see in the 80s.
You only have to pay half the wages as well.
Yeah. One thing I was curious to ask Paul is, you know, getting into the writing the paperbacks, the novels, and I'm guessing short stories as well, because you and I have conversed on Facebook a lot about mystery writers and, you know, writing action novels and using pseudonyms. Where did you find the time or the interest or ambition to do this while you were a police officer?
That's a question I actually get asked a lot because, you know, quite frankly, I juggled two careers for, you know, I was with the department for 35 years and 30 of those years I was working as a professional writer at the same time. Right. I don't know when you love something enough and I was doing the two things I love most, putting villains in jail and putting words on paper. I was just a very lucky guy and was just, you know, having the time of my life doing that. I've always been a voracious reader, and so the writing was just kind of a natural offspring out of that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the opportunities presented themselves and kept presenting themselves, and I just kept tapping away at the keyboard and then getting up the next morning and strapping on my gun and going to work.
Wow. So did you get to a point where if you wrote a bestseller that you would be like, okay, I'm hanging up my badge or whatever?
I fortunately was never put in that position, or unfortunately was never put in that position.
I was about to say, that might have been a good problem to have.
Right, it would have been a good problem to have. Those are nice problems to have. I mean, I think that type of situation, that happened to Joe Wamba, where his celebrity as a writer made it very, very difficult for him to do his job. And so really, the best thing he could do was to leave the department and pursue his writing dreams because it was all coming together for him at that point. And perhaps that's what would have happened to me if I'd ever broken out of the mid list.
Right.
You grab your badge and throw it in the river, man, like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, and I'm not coming back.
That's it.
Unless they make a sequel, then.
Yeah.
Then he has to go deep sea diving for that badge he's throwing the river. Yeah.
Hold on. I always imagined, like, Clint coming back to the river and going, oh, just kidding, I need this.
Yeah. I mean, he's in Magnum Force.
He wanted to be like Samuel Jackson in The Last Shaft, where he throws his badge across the room and embeds it in the wall. Kind of spots his head.
Yeah.
I never saw the Samuel L. Jackson Shaft.
Didn't miss anything. Trust me.
I've only ever seen the first one. I never saw Shaft's Big Score or Shaft in Africa.
You should see
man, Shaft's Big Score.
They are.
I wouldn't say in Africa. It was all right. Big Score was great. I really enjoyed that a lot. But I didn't like In Africa a great deal. It was okay.
My favorite Sylvester Stallone film outside of Rocky is Nighthawks. At the end of the movie, he's down on the railroad tracks in a physical confrontation, a Chuck Norris type fight with the terrorist, and he finally knocks him out, and then just reaches down and grabs him by the ankle and starts walking along, going, "You have the right to remain silent." I thought, now that's cool, completely unrealistic, completely ridiculous, but cool.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's back when Stallone made really interesting movies and wasn't trying to be a superhero in every movie.
Right before the 80s and steroids.
Cobra, where he's like punching out his superior.
Cobra, my favorite thing about Cobra is him eating pizza with scissors.
that actually is the best scene in the movie.
Yeah.
De Blasio adopted that method years later, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, only with a knife and fork, though.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. That's one thing that's like instant. If you want to create instant controversy, go to New York and eat pizza with a knife and fork. Like, people freaked out when de Blasio did it. They freaked out when Trump and Palin did it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty good stuff.
It's funny.
Eat pizza with the chopsticks.
One time on one of Paul's... Paul complained on Facebook saying he was so tired of police officer movies where it's always a revenge motivation. It's never... just a day at work where they take on a case. You know, it's in movies, it's always they killed his partner, they killed his family, something like that. And so I went ahead and just wrote an entire treatment on his Facebook post of a cop film. And it was every awful cliche you've ever seen with his partner being killed at the retirement party. You know, the mobsters drive by with a shotgun and said, "You'll never see retirement, Rossetti," or whatever. So
So basically, you wrote the treatment for New Jack City, did you?
Pretty much.
Yeah, well, I was about to say.
As it built, I realized it was every Stallone movie because I said he has a souped-up car that there's just no way in hell he would be able to afford it on a real police officer's salary. He has this like super classic old car that he's got in a garage that he never drives until he's got to go to war, right? And you have the rock music and he's. You know, suddenly he knows where the villain is and where all the villain's henchmen hang out because he'll show up at the bars and torture them until he gets all the information he needs warehouse shootout at the end, you know?
Did you shoehorn a song by Survivor in there as well somehow?
Yeah, yeah. That
sounds like a blockbuster to me.
Yeah, John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band.
Like, yeah.
You know, Child of the City or Heart of the City or something at the end of Cobra. Just every awful scene and, you know... hanging the henchmen upside down to find out where the mob boss is. It's always the same.
You know what the best day in the life of a cop movie is? Dread.
No, really, yeah.
There you go.
There's some woman called Mama who's just distributing drugs around an apartment.
Yeah, it's just a day in the life of Judge Dredd, you know? Goes to the apartment, get locked in, gotta shoot my way out. Oh, rookie,
that's just New Jack City again. Mama is just Wesley Snipes. That's all it is.
Mixed with Game of Death. You know?
Everything comes back to New Jack City. It's one of the greatest films
and
ever.
And there's the other cliche that cop movies are always doing. They have the absolute luxury of working one case at a time.
Oh, yeah.
I've never had that luxury.
Wow.
Because movies have also created the false assumption that Ice-T is a police officer.
Yes,
you know.
Yes,
people.
You know what? You go from the extremes of films like the Stallone one to Bad Lieutenant, which is the other end.
Oh yeah, what do you think of Bad Lieutenant?
It is what it is, right? I mean, it's a great character piece. It's a great Harvey Keitel movie, being Harvey Keitel.
Did you see the Nick Cage one?
You know, nothing to do with reality.
Did you see the Nicolas Cage one?
No,
it's that
Why would you?
I'd have to arrest myself if I went to a Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah, but well, it's directed by Werner Herzog. All right.
Oh God.
It's Nick Cage and Val Kilmer.
And a bunch of midgets out in the Machu Picchu rainforest.
Yes. No, yeah, it's actually it's a really bizarre movie.
I thought it was lame, but everybody else loved it.
I thought it was interesting. I didn't, you know, it's not as good as the Keitel one, but I thought it was interesting.
It was just local flavor, you know.
What about Night Patrol? What are your thoughts on Night Patrol? Have you seen that film?
I haven't seen that one. No, sorry.
Consider yourself lucky. You're so lucky.
You don't be sorry.
I don't even know what y'all are talking about. Night Patrol.
It was a failed movie launch for the Unknown Comic.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The Murray, what's his name?
Do you know the Unknown Comic? Murray Langston.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Linda Blair as well. Like, really,
it's a police squad
chunky,
ripoff.
Fat, yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Well, any movie with Linda Blair that isn't The Exorcist that has her in it, the movie's ratings knock down a few notches. You know?
But she's topless quite a bit throughout the movie. That helps.
Well, my favorite day in the life of a cop movie is Detective Story with Kirk Douglas.
Of course, Kirk.
He goes through every range of human emotion in that movie.
That's a brilliant film.
I love it. It's one of my favorites. It's probably my all-time favorite performance. I'll put it over a lot of Brando's stuff. It's just amazing. And people who just think of Kirk Douglas as being this guy who was in all these B-movies as he got older, it's like, you got to go back and watch Detective Story.
Kirk Douglas has a lot of great performances. Young Man with the Horn.
It's like, I can't recommend it enough.
One of my favorite Kirk Douglas films is one called Cat and Mouse he did from, like 79, 80, where he played this deranged killer with spectacles and... A good movie. I don't know if it was a TV movie or something, but saw it on video, many, many years ago. It was good. Really enjoyed it. Enjoyed it more than friggin' Spartacus, that's for sure.
There you go.
Spartacus. Spartacus is so overrated.
It really is. Yeah. I want to get your thoughts on other films that I'm going to throw at you. Dark Blue.
Again, not on my radar.
It's written by... David Ayer, who wrote Training Day and did End of Watch.
Yeah, two other very realistic films.
I love End of Watch was my favorite movie of that year. I wanted to ask you what you thought of that.
You know, I couldn't watch it.
Really?
I just couldn't watch it. It just, although the action wasn't realistic, right. the emotion was.
Yeah, the action in it was a little bit, but I love the characters in it. I love the dialogue and the squad car and stuff. I thought it was great.
Yeah. And so
Let's Be Cops.
My favorite.
Never saw it.
Right on the money.
That would honestly, I saw the trailer for that when I went and watched Annabelle. I was like, this is about as dumbed down as you could possibly get, not just for police officer portrayals, but anything in life. It was just fucking hideous.
Yeah, well, how about, the 22 Jump Street?
Creatures? Oh, yeah.
Jesus. No, I never watched it. No. Didn't even watch 21 Jump Street with notorious heroin dealer Johnny Depp in it. Yes. Yeah. Like, not interested.
Johnny Depp getting shot in the neck in that movie, them killing off his character from the show is pretty great.
But
those are an example of where things get bad, though, because I always argue with people. They're like, oh, you're a cynic. You don't like all these superhero movies that we love. And I'm like, my problem is there's no mid-list of the old cop movies I like. Nobody's trying to make a new French Connection or a new Dirty Harry or a Serpico.
I think David Ayer, the
French Connection is fantastic.
Yeah, I think David Ayer, like with some of it, with like End of Watch, did a pretty good job with
it. He did, but then what happens? Then he's doing superhero Suicide Squad.
No, you're right. You know. I mean, I just think he's done some good cop movies.
I like some of those. I like Street Kings, and I liked
Is rad. I like that.
Yeah, it's like, and I liked Rampart with Woody Harrelson. I even enjoyed that.
What about? I was going to ask you about a film like To Live and Die in L.A. What your thoughts were on something like that?
You know, I actually know Gerald Petovich, who wrote the book that was based on, that actually there's the fight scene in the locker room of that film. And Friedkin, the director, did was that the two white guys in that scene playing the cops were actually real police officers, off duty, obviously, doing their acting. And the two black guys were actually pretty much thugs. And so the director went over to the black guys and said, "All those cops are talking, you know, really bad stuff about you, blah, 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 blah," getting them all piled up. Then he went over to the cops and said, "You know, those two black guys over there, they're really, you know, dissing the cops and they hate cops and blah,
sounds
blah,
like
blah,
freaking,
blah."
Yeah.
And now we film them in a fight scene. And if you look at that fight scene, there are no punches being pulled. They are after each other.
Mm.
And the other really interesting thing about that film is when the big freeway chase is on at the end, he actually put the traffic on opposite sides of the freeway to what it normally would be to cause a certain amount of disorientation in the viewer when they're looking at it. They know something's wrong, but they can't quite pick up what it is.
Yeah, it's a brilliant chase scene.
So there was some really good stuff in there.
Great movie as well. Better than Night Patrol anyway. Say that much.
We'll wrap it up here. But thank you so much for coming on, Paul.
It's been a blast. I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Yeah, so again, paulbishopbooks.com. That's where you can find Paul and all of his stuff. Look him up on Twitter, Bish's Beat, Facebook, all that good stuff. So until next time, guys, you want to sign off?
Adios. Yeah,
mahalo. Adios.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Team.